Dale has known that Jack believes this, knew it from his face outside, but hearing it is still an unhappy thump. He sits back, disappointed. Deduction or intuition? Henry asks. Both, Jack says. And stop looking like I plugged your mother, Dale. You may still have the key to this thing. Rails back? Jack makes a seesawing gesture with one hand. Maybe, maybe not, it says. Rails back probably saw what the fisherman wanted him to see. Although the single slipper is intriguing, and I want to ask Rails back about it. But if Mr. One Slipper was the fisherman, why would he lead Railsback and us to Potter? To get us off his trail, Dale says. Oh, have we been on it? Jack asks politely. And when neither of them answers, but say he thinks we're on his trail. I can almost buy that, especially if he just remembered some goof he might have made. Nothing back yet on the 7-Eleven phone, one way or the other, if that's what you're thinking of, Dale tells him. Jack appears to ignore this. His eyes gaze off into the middle distance. That little smile is back on his face. Dale looks at Henry and sees Henry looking at Jack. Unc's smile is easier to read. Relief and delight. Look at that, Dale thinks. He's doing what he was built to do. By God, even a blind man can see it. Why Potter? Jack finally repeats. Why not one of the Thunder Five, or the Hindu at the 7-Eleven, or Artist Walker down at the bait shop? Why not Reverend Hovala? What motive usually surfaces when you uncover a frame job? Dale thinks it over. Payback, he says at last. Revenge. In the ready room, a phone rings. Shut up, shut up, Ernie bellows to the others. Let's try to act professional here for 30 seconds or so. Jack, meanwhile, is nodding at Dale. I think I need to question Potter, and rather closely. Dale looks alarmed. Then you better get on it right away, before Brown and Black... He comes to a halt, frowning, with his head cocked. A rumbling sound has impinged on his attention. It's low, but rising. Uncle Henry, what's that? Motors, Henry says promptly. A lot of them. They're east of here, but coming this way, edge of town. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but it sounds like the party next door is, like, over, dude. As if this were a cue, Ernie Terrio's distressed cry comes through the door. Oh, shit! Dit Jesperson. What's Ernie? Get the chief! Ah, never mind, I'll... There is a single perfunctory knock, and then Ernie's looking in at the brain trust. He's as collected and soldierly as ever, but his cheeks have paled considerably beneath his summer tan, and a vein is pulsing in the middle of his forehead. Chief, I just took a call on the 911. 20 was the sandbar? That hole, Dale mutters. Caller was the bartender. It says about 50 to 70 people are on their way. By now, the sound of approaching engines is very loud. It sounds to Henry like the Indy 500, just before the pace car runs for dear life and the checkered flag drops. Don't tell me, Dale says. What do I need to make my day complete? Let me think. They're coming to take my prisoner. Yes, sir, that's what the caller said, Ernie agrees. Behind him, the other cops are silent. In that moment, they don't look like cops at all to Dale. They look like nothing but dismayed faces, crudely drawn in a dozen or so white balloons. Also two black ones, can't forget Pam Stevens and Bob Holtz. The sound of the engines continues to grow. Also might want to know one other thing the caller said. Christ, what? Said the, Ernie searches for a word that isn't mob. The protest group was being led by the Freneau girl's mom. Oh, my Christ, Dale says. He gives Jack a look of sick panic and utter frustration. The look of a man who knows he is dreaming but can't seem to wake up no matter how hard he tries. If I lose Potter, Jack, French Landing is going to be the lead story on CNN tomorrow morning. Jack opens his mouth to reply, and the cell phone in his pocket picks that moment to start up its annoying tweet. Henry Layden immediately crosses his arms and tucks his hands into his armpits. Don't hand it to me, he says. Cell phones give you cancer. We agreed on that. Dale, meanwhile, has left the room. As Jack digs for the cell phone, thinking someone has picked a cataclysmically shitty time to ask him about his network television preferences, Henry follows his nephew, walking briskly, with his hands now held slightly out, fingers gently fluttering the air, seeming to read the currents for obstacles. Jack hears Dale saying that if he sees a single drawn weapon, the person who drew it will join Arnie Hrabrowski on the suspension list. Jack is thinking exactly one thing. No one is taking Potter anywhere until Jack Sawyer has had time to put a few pointed questions. No way. He flicks the cell phone open and says, "Not now, whoever you are. We've got hidey-ho, traveling Jack," says the voice from the phone. And for Jack Sawyer, the years once more roll away. "Speedy?" "The very one," Speedy says. Then the drawl is gone. The voice becomes brisk and businesslike. "And as one coppersman to another, son, I think you ought to visit Chief Gilbertson's private bathroom right now." Outside, there are enough vehicles arriving to shake the building. Jack has had a bad feeling about this, has since he heard Ernie say who was leading the fool's parade. "Speedy, I don't exactly have the time to visit the facilities right now." "You haven't got time to visit any place else," Speedy replies coldly. Only now he's the other one, the hard boy named Parkus. "But you're going to find air you can use twice. But if you don't use it almighty quick the first time, you won't need it the second time, because that man is going to be up a lamppost." And just like that, Speedy is gone. When Tansy leads the willing patrons into the sandbar's parking lot, there is none of the carnival raucousness that was the keynote of the clusterfuck at Ed's Eats and Dogs. Although most of the folks we met at Ed's have been spending the evening in the bar getting moderately to seriously tanked, they are quiet, even funereal, as they follow Tansy out and fire up their cars and pickups. But it's a savage funerality. She has taken something in from Gorg, some stone powerful poison, and passed it along to them. In the belt of her slacks is a single crow feather. Doodle Sanger takes her arm and guides her sweetly to Teddy Runkleman's International Harvester pickup. When Tansy heads for the truck bed, which already holds two men and one hefty female in a white rayon waitress's uniform, Doodle steers her toward the cab. "No, honey," Doodle says, "you sit up there. Be comfy." Doodles wants that last place in the truck bed. She spotted something and knows just what to do with it. Doodles is quick with her hands. Always has been. The fog isn't thick this far from the river, but after 24 cars and trucks have spun out of the bar's dirt parking lot, following Teddy Runkleman's dented one taillight IH, you can barely see the tavern. Inside, only half a dozen people are left. These were somehow immune to Tansy's eerily powerful voice. One of them is Stinky Cheese, the bartender. Stinky has a lot of liquid assets to protect out here and isn't going anywhere. When he calls 911 and speaks to Ernie Terrio, it will be mostly in the spirit of petulance. If he can't go along and enjoy the fun, by God, at least he can spoil it for the rest of those monkeys. 20 vehicles leave the sandbar. By the time the caravan passes Ed's Eats, the lane leading to it cordoned off by yellow tape, and the no trespassing sign alongside the overgrown lane to that queer, forgotten house, not cordoned off, not even noticed for that matter, the caravan has grown to 30. There are 50 cars and trucks rolling down both lanes of Route 35 by the time the mob reaches Gultz's. And by the time it passes the 7-Eleven, there must be 80 vehicles or more, and maybe 250 people. Credit this unnaturally rapid swelling to the ubiquitous cell phone. Teddy Runkleman, oddly silent, he is in fact afraid of the pallid woman sitting beside him, her snarling mouth and her wide, unblinking eyes, brings his old truck to a halt in front of the FLPD parking lot entrance. Sumner Street is steep here, and he sets the parking brake. The other vehicles halt behind him, filling the street from side to side, rumbling through rusty mufflers and blatting through broken exhaust pipes. Misaligned headlights stab the fog like searchlight beams at a movie premiere. The night's dank, wet fish smell has been overlaid with odors of burning gas, boiling oil, and cooking clutch lining. After a moment, doors begin to open and then clap shut. But there is no conversation. No yelling. No indecorous yee-haw whooping. Not tonight. The newcomers stand in clusters around the vehicles that brought them, watching as the people in the back of Teddy's truck either jump over the sides or slip off the end of the tailgate, watching as Teddy crosses to the passenger door, at this moment as attentive as a young man arriving with his date at the junior prom, watching as he helps down the slim young woman who has lost her daughter. The mist seems to outline her somehow and give her a bizarre electric aura, the same blue of the sodium lights on Beezer's upper arm. The crowd gives out a collective and weirdly amorous sigh when it sees her. She is what connects them. All her life, Tansy Freneau has been the forgotten one. Even Cubby Freneau forgot her eventually, running off to Green Bay and leaving her here to work odd jobs and collect the ADC. Only Irma remembered her. Only Irma cared. And now Irma is dead. Not here to see, unless she's looking down from heaven, Tansy thinks, in some distant and ever-receding part of her mind, her mother suddenly idolized. Tansy Freneau has tonight become the dearest subject of French Landing's eye and heart, not its mind, because its mind is temporarily gone, perhaps in search of its conscience, but certainly of its eye and heart, yes. And now, as delicately as the girl she once was, Doodles Sanger approaches this woman of the hour. What Doodles spotted lying on the floor of Teddy's truck bed was an old length of rope, dirty and oily, but thick enough to do the trick. Below Doodles' petite fist hangs the noose that her clever hands have fashioned on the ride into town. She hands it to Tansy, who holds it up in the misty light. The crowd lets out another sigh. Noose raised, looking like a female Diogenes in search of an honest man rather than for a cannibal in need of lynching, Tansy walks, delicate herself in her jeans and blood-stained sweatshirt, into the parking lot. Teddy, Doodles, and Freddy Sacknessum walk behind her, and behind them come the rest. They move toward the police station like the tide. The Thunder Five are still standing with their backs to the brick wall and their arms folded. "What the fuck do we do?" Mouse asks. "I don't know about you," Beezer says, "but I'm going to stand here until they grab me, which they probably will." He's looking at the woman with the upraised noose. He's a big boy, and he's been in a lot of hard corners, but this chick frightens him with her blank, wide eyes, like the eyes of a statue. And there's something stuck in her belt, something black. Is it a knife? Some kind of dagger? "And I'm not going to fight because it won't work." "They'll lock the door, right?" Doc asks nervously. "I mean, the cops will lock the door." "I imagine," Beezer says, never taking his eyes from Tansy Freneau. "But if these folks want Potter, they'll have him on the half shell. Look at him, for Christ's sake. There's a couple of hundred." Tansy stops, the noose still held up. "Bring him out," she says. Her voice is louder than it should be, as if some doctor has cunningly hidden an amplifying gadget in her throat. "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" Doodles joins in. "Bring him out!" And Teddy, "Give us the killer!" And Freddy, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" And then the rest. It could be almost the soundtrack of George Rathbun's Badger Barrage, only instead of "Block That Kick" or "On Wisconsin," they are screaming, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" "They're going to take him," Beezer murmurs. He turns to his troops, his eyes both fierce and frightened. Sweat stands out on his broad forehead in large, perfect drops. "When she's got him pumped up to high, she'll come and they'll be right on her ass. Don't run, don't even unfold your arms. And when they grab you, let it happen. If you want to see daylight tomorrow, let it happen." The crowd stands knee-deep in fog like spoiled skim milk, chanting, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" Wendell Green is chanting right along with them, but that doesn't keep him from continuing to take pictures. Because, shit, this is the story of a lifetime. From the door behind Beezer, there's a click. "Yeah, they locked it," he thinks. "Thanks, you whores." But it's the latch, not the lock. The door opens. Jack Sawyer steps out. He walks past Beezer without looking or reacting as Beez mutters, "Hey, man, I wouldn't go near her." Jack advances slowly but not hesitantly into the no-man's land between the building and the mob, with the woman standing at its head. Lady Liberty with the upraised hangman's noose instead of a torch in her hand. In his simple gray collarless shirt and dark pants, Jack looks like a cavalier from some old romantic tale advancing to propose marriage. The flowers he holds in his own hand add to this impression. These tiny white blooms are what Speedy left for him beside the sink in Dale's bathroom, a cluster of impossibly fragrant white blossoms. They are lilies of the Vale, and they are from the territories. Speedy left him no explanation about how to use them, but Jack needs none. The crowd falls silent. Only Tansy, lost in the world Gorg has made for her, continues to chant, "Bring him out! Give us the killer!" She doesn't stop until Jack is directly in front of her, and he doesn't kid himself that it's his handsome face or dashing figure that ends the too loud repetition. It is the smell of the flowers, their sweet and vibrant smell, the exact opposite of the meaty stench that hung over Ed's eats. Her eyes clear, a little at least. "Bring him out," she says to Jack. Almost a question. "No," he says, and the word is filled with heartbreaking tenderness. "No, dear." Behind them, Doodle Sanger suddenly thinks of her father for the first time in maybe 20 years and begins to weep. "Bring him out," Tansy pleads. Now her own eyes are filling. "Bring out the monster who killed my pretty baby." "If I had him, maybe I would," Jack says. "Maybe I would at that, although he knows better. But the guy we've got's not the guy you want. He's not the one." "But Gorg said..." Here is a word he knows. One of the words Judy Marshall tried to eat. Jack, not in the territories, but not entirely in this world right now either, reaches forward and plucks the feather from her belt. "Did Gorg give you this?"
"Yes."
Jack lets it drop, then steps on it. For a moment he thinks, knows, that he feels it buzzing angrily beneath the sole of his shoe, like a half-crushed wasp. Then it stills. Gorg lies, Tansy. Whatever Gorg is, he lies. The man in there is not the one. Tansy lets out a great wail and drops the rope. Behind her, the crowd sighs. Jack puts his arm around her, and again he thinks of George Potter's painful dignity. He thinks of all the lost, struggling along without a single clean territory's dawn to light their way. He hugs her to him, smelling sweat and grief and madness and coffee brandy. In her ear, Jack whispers, "I'll catch him for you, Tansy." She stiffens.
"You..."
"Yes."
"You promise?"
"Yes."
"He's not the one?"
"No, dear."
"You swear?"
Jack hands her the lilies and says, "On my mother's name." She lowers her nose to the flowers and inhales deeply. When her head comes up again, Jack sees that the danger has left her, but not the insanity. She's one of the lost ones now. Something has gotten to her. Maybe if the fisherman is caught, it will leave her. Jack would like to believe that. "Someone needs to take this lady home," Jack says. He speaks in a mild, conversational voice, but it still carries to the crowd. She's very tired and full of sadness.
"I'll do it," Doodle says.
Her cheeks gleam with tears.
"I'll take her in Teddy's truck, and if he don't give me the keys, I'll knock him down.
And that's when the chant starts again, this time from back in the crowd. "Bring him out! Give us the killer! Give us the fisherman! Bring out the fisherman!" For a moment it's a solo job, and then a few other hesitant voices begin to join in and lend harmony. Still standing with his back against the bricks, Beezer St. Pierre says, "Ah, shit, here we go again."
Jack forbade Dale to come out into the parking lot with him, saying that the sight of Dale's uniform might set off the crowd. He didn't mention the little bouquet of flowers he was holding, and Dale barely noticed them. He was too terrified of losing Potter to Wisconsin's first lynching in 200 years. He followed Jack downstairs, however, and has now commandeered the peephole in the door by right of seniority. The rest of the FLPD is still upstairs, looking out of the ready room windows. Henry has ordered Bobby Dulac to give him a running play-by-play. Even in his current state of worry about Jack, Henry thinks there's at least a 40% chance the mob will either trample him or tear him apart. Henry is amused and flattered to realize that Bobby is doing George Rathbun without even realizing it. Okay, Hollywood's out there. He approaches the woman. No sign of fear. The rest of them are quiet. Jack and the woman appear to be talking, and holy Jesus, he's given her a bouquet of flowers. What a ploy! Ploy is one of George Rathbun's favorite sports terms, as in the Brew Crew's hit-and-run ploy failed yet again last night at Miller Park. She's turning away, Bobby yells jubilantly. He grabs Henry's shoulder and shakes it. Hot damn, I think it's over. I think Jack turned her off. Even a blind man could see he turned her off, Henry says. Just in time, too, Bobby says. Here's Channel 5, and there's another truck with one of those big orange poles on it. Fox Milwaukee, I think. Bring him out, a voice outside begins yelling. It sounds cheated and indignant. Give us the killer! Give us the fisherman! Oh, no, Bobby says, even now sounding like George Rathbun, telling his morning after audience how another Badger rally had started to fizzle. Not now, not with the TV here. That's... Bring out the fisherman! Henry already knows who that is. Even through two layers of chicken wire reinforced glass, that high yapping cry is impossible to mistake. Wendell Green understands his job. Don't ever make the mistake of thinking he doesn't. His job is to report the news, to analyze the news, to sometimes photojournalize the news. His job is not to make the news. But tonight he can't help it. This is the second time in the last 12 hours that a career maker of a story has been extended to his grasping, pleading hands, only to be snatched away at the last second. Bring him out! Wendell bawls. The raw strength in his voice surprises, then thrills him. Give us the killer! Give us the fisherman! The sound of other voices joining in with his provides an incredible rush. It is, as his old college roommate used to say, a real zipper buster. Wendell takes a step forward, his chest swelling, his cheeks reddening, his confidence building. He's vaguely aware that the Action News 5 truck is rolling slowly toward him through the crowd. Soon there will be 10Ks and 5Ks shining through the fog. Soon there will be TV cameras rolling tape by their harsh light. So what? If the woman in the blood-spattered sweatshirt was in the end too chicken to stand up for her own kid, Wendell will do it for her. Wendell Green, shining exemplar of civic responsibility. Wendell Green, leader of the people. He begins to pump his camera up and down. It's exhilarating, like being back in college at a Skynyrd concert, stoned. It's like there is a huge flash in front of Wendell Green's eyes. Then the lights go out. All of them. Arnie hit him with his flashlight, Bobby is screaming. He grabs Dale's blind uncle by the shoulders and whirls him in a delirious circle. A thick aroma of aqua velva descends toward Henry, who knows Bobby's going to kiss him on both cheeks French style a second before Bobby actually does this. And when Bobby's narration resumes, he sounds as transported as George Rathbun on those rare occasions when the local sports teams actually buck the odds and grab the gold. Can you believe it? The mad Hungarian hit him with his ever-loving flashlight, and Green's down! The fucking Hungarian has put everyone's favorite asshole reporter on the mat! Way to go, Hrabowski! All around them, cops are cheering at the tops of their lungs. Debbie Anderson starts chanting, "We are the champions," and other voices quickly lend support. These are strange days in French Landing, Henry thinks. He stands with his hands in his pockets, smiling, listening to the bedlam. There's no lie in the smile. He's happy, but he's also uneasy in his heart, afraid for Jack. Afraid for all of them, really. That was good work, man, Beezer tells Jack. I mean, balls to the wall. Jack nods. Thanks.
I'm not going to ask you again if that was the guy. You say he's not, he's not. But anything we can do to help you find the right one, you just call us.
The other members of the Thunder Five rumble assent. Kaiser Bill gives Jack a friendly bop on the shoulder. It will probably leave a bruise.
Thanks, Jack says again.
Before he can knock on the door, it's opened. Dale grabs him and gives him a crushing embrace. When their chests touch, Jack can feel Dale's heart beating hard and fast.
You saved my ass, Dale says into his ear. Anything I can do, you can do something, all right, Jack says, pulling him inside.
I saw another cop car behind the news trucks. Couldn't tell for sure, but I think this one was blue.
Uh-oh, Dale says.
Uh-oh is right. I need at least 20 minutes with Potter. It might not get us anything, but it might get us a lot. Can you hold off Brown and Black for 20 minutes?
Dale gives his friend a grim little smile. I'll see you get half an hour, minimum.
That's great. And the 911 tape of the fisherman's call, do you still have that?
It went with the rest of the evidence we were holding after Brown and Black took the case. A trooper picked it up this afternoon.
Dale, no.
Easy, big boy. I've got a cassette copy safe in my desk.
Jack pats his chest. Don't scare me that way.
Sorry, Dale says, thinking seeing you out there, I wouldn't have guessed you were afraid of anything.
Halfway up the stairs, Jack remembers Speedy telling him he could use what had been left in the bathroom twice, but he has given the flowers to Tansy for now. Shit. Then he cups his hands over his nose, inhales, and smiles. Maybe he still has them after all.
Chapter 17.
George Potter is sitting on the bunk in the third holding cell down a short corridor that smells of piss and disinfectant. He's looking out the window at the parking lot, which has lately been the scene of so much excitement, and which is still full of milling people. He doesn't turn at the sound of Jack's approaching footfalls. As he walks, Jack passes two signs. One call means one call, reads the first. AA meetings Monday at 7 p.m., NA meetings Thursday at 8 p.m., reads the second. There's a dusty drinking fountain and an ancient fire extinguisher, which some wit has labeled laughing gas. Jack reaches the bars of the cell and raps on one with his house key. Potter at last turns away from the window. Jack, still in that state of hyper-awareness that he now recognizes as a kind of territorial residue, knows the essential truth of the man at a single look. It's in the sunken eyes and the dark hollows beneath them. It's in the sallow cheeks and the slightly hollowed temples with their delicate nestles of veins. It's in the too sharp prominence of the nose.
"Hello, Mr. Potter," he says. "I want to talk to you, and we have to make it fast."
"They wanted me," Potter remarks.
"Yes.
Maybe you should have let him take me. Another 3-4 months, I'm out of the race anyway."
In his breast pocket is the mag card Dale has given him, and Jack uses it to unlock the cell door. There's a harsh buzzing as it trundles back on its short track. When Jack removes the key, the buzzing stops. Downstairs in the ready room, an amber light marked HC3 will now be glowing. Jack comes in and sits down on the end of the bunk. He has put his key ring away, not wanting the metallic smell to corrupt the scent of lilies.
"Where have you got it?"
Without asking how Jack knows, Potter raises one large, gnarled hand, a carpenter's hand, and touches his midsection. Then he lets it drop.
"Started in the gut. That was 5 years ago. I took the pills and the shots like a good boy. La Riviere, that was. That stuff. Man, I was throwing up everywhere. Corners and just about everywhere. Once I threw up in my own bed and didn't even know it. Woke up the next morning with puke drying on my chest. You know anything about that, son?"
"My mother had cancer," Jack says quietly, "when I was 12. Then it went away."
"She get 5 years?"
"More."
"Lucky," Potter says. "Got her in the end, though, didn't it?"
Jack nods. Potter nods back. They're not quite friends yet, but it's edging that way.
It's how Jack works, always has been. That shit gets in and waits, Potter tells him. My theory is that it never goes away, not really. Anyway, shots is done, pills is done too, except for the ones that kill the pain. I come here for the finish.
Why? This is not a thing Jack needs to know, and time is short. But it's his technique, and he won't abandon what works just because there are a couple of state police jarheads downstairs waiting to take his boy. Dale will have to hold them off, that's all.
Seems like a nice enough little town. And I like the river. I go down every day. Like to watch the sun on the water. Sometimes I think of all the jobs I did. Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois. And then sometimes I don't think about much of anything. Sometimes I just sit there on the bank and feel at peace.
What was your line of work, Mr. Potter?
Started out as a carpenter, just like Jesus. Progressed to builder and then got too big for my britches. When that happens to a builder, he usually goes around calling himself a contractor. I made $3-4 million, had a Cadillac, had a young woman who hauled my ashes Friday nights. Nice young woman, no trouble. Then I lost it all. Only thing I missed was the Cadillac. It had a smoother ride than the woman. Then I got my bad news and come here.
He looks at Jack.
You know what I think sometimes? That French Landing's close to a better world. One where things look and smell better. Maybe where people act better. I don't go around with folks. I'm not a friendly type person, but that doesn't mean I don't feel things. I got this idea in my head that it's not too late to be decent. You think I'm crazy?
No, Jack tells him. That's pretty much why I came here myself. I'll tell you how it is for me. You know how if you put a thin blanket over a window, the sun will still shine through? George Potter looks at him with eyes that are suddenly alight. Jack doesn't even have to finish the thought, which is good. He has found the wavelength. He almost always does. It's his gift. And now it's time to get down to business.
You do know, Potter says simply.
Jack nods. You know why you're here?
They think I killed that lady's kid.
Potter nods toward the window.
The one out there that was holding up the noose. I didn't. That's what I know.
Okay, that's a start. Listen to me now. Very quickly, Jack lays out the chain of events that has brought Potter to this cell. Potter's brow furrows as Jack speaks, and his big hands knot together.
Rails back, he says at last. I should have known. Nosy, goddamn old man, always asking questions, always asking, do you want to play cards or maybe shoot some pool or, I don't know, play Parcheesi, for Christ's sake. Also, he can ask questions, goddamn nosy Parker.
There's more in this vein, and Jack lets him go on with it for a while. Cancer or no cancer, this old fellow has been ripped out of his ordinary routine without much mercy and needs to vent a little. If Jack cuts him off to save time, he'll lose it instead. It's hard to be patient. How is Dale holding those two assholes off? Jack doesn't even want to know. But patience is necessary. When Potter begins to widen the scope of his attack, however, Morty Fine comes in for some abuse, as does Andy Railsback's pal Irv Throneberry. Jack steps in. The point is, Mr. Potter, that Railsback followed someone to your room. No, that's the wrong way to put it. Railsback was led to your room. Potter doesn't reply, just sits looking at his hands. But he nods. He's old, he's sick and getting sicker, but he's four counties over from stupid. The person who led Railsback was almost certainly the same person who left the Polaroids of the dead children in your closet.
Yeah, makes sense. And if he had pictures of the dead kiddies, he was probably the one who made him dead.
Right. So I have to wonder. Potter waves an impatient hand.
I guess I know what you got to wonder.
who there is around these parts who'd like to see Chicago Potsy strung up by the neck. Or the balls.
Exactly.
Don't want to put a stick in your spokes, Sonny, but I can't think of nobody.
No? Jack raises his eyebrows. Never did business around here? Built a house or laid out a golf course?
Potter raises his head and gives Jack an impatient look. Course I did. How else do you think I knew how nice it is, especially in the summer? You know the part of town they call Libertyville? Got all those ye olde streets like Camelot and Avalon?
Jack nods.
I built half of those, back in the 70s. There was a fella around then, some moke I knew from Chicago, or thought I knew. Was he in the business?
This last seems to be Potter addressing Potter. In any case, he gives his head a brief shake.
Can't remember. Doesn't matter anyway. How could it? Fella was getting on then. Must be dead now. It was a long time ago.
But Jack, who interrogates says Jerry Lee Lewis once played the piano, thinks it does matter. In the usually dim section of his mind where intuition keeps its headquarters, lights are coming on. Not a lot yet, but maybe more than just a few. A moke, he says, as if he has never heard the word before. What's that? Potter gives him a brief, irritated look.
A citizen who... Well, not exactly a citizen. Someone who knows people who are connected. Or maybe sometimes connected people call him. Maybe they do each other favors. A moke. It's not the world's best thing to be.
No, Jack thinks. But moking can get you a Cadillac with that nice smooth ride. Were you ever a moke, George? Gotta get a little more intimate now. This is not a question Jack can address to a Mr. Potter.
Maybe, Potter says after a grudging, considering pause. Maybe I was, back in Chi. In Chi, you had to scratch backs and wet beaks if you wanted to land the big contract. I don't know how it is there now, but in those days, a clean contractor was a poor contractor, you know.
Jack nods.
The biggest deal I ever made was a housing development on the south side of Chicago. Just like in that song about bad, bad Leroy Brown.
Potter chuckles rustily. For a moment, he's not thinking about cancer or false accusations or almost being lynched. He's living in the past. And it may be a little sleazy, but it's better than the present. The bunk chained to the wall, the steel toilet, the cancer spreading through his guts.
Man, that one was big. I kid you not. Lots of federal money. But the local hotshots decided where the dough went home at night. And me and this other guy, this moke, we were in a horse race.
He breaks off, looking at Jack with wide eyes.
Holy shit. What are you, magic?
I don't know what you mean. I'm just sitting here.
That guy was the guy who showed up here. That was the moke.
I'm not following you, George. But Jack thinks he is. And although he's starting to get excited, he shows it no more than he did when the bartender told him about Kinderling's little nose-pinching trick.
It's probably nothing, Potter says. Guy had plenty of reasons not to like yours truly, but he's got to be dead. He'd be in his 80s, for Christ's sake.
Tell me about him, Jack says.
He was a moke, Potter repeats, as if this explains everything. And he must have gotten trouble in Chicago or somewhere around Chicago because when he showed up here, I'm pretty sure he was using a different name.
When did you swink him on the housing development deal, George? Potter smiles, and something about the size of his teeth and the way they seem to jut from the gums allows Jack to see how fast death is rushing toward this man. He feels a little shiver of goose flesh, but he returns the smile easily enough. This is also how he works.
If we're gonna talk about moking and swinking, you better call me Potsy.
All right, Potsy. When did you swink this guy in Chicago?
That much is easy, Potter says. It was summer when the bids went out. But the hotshots were still bellering about how the hippies came to town the year before and gave the cops and the mayor a black eye. So I'd say 1969. What happened was I'd done the building commissioner a big favor, and I'd done another for this old woman who swung weight on this special equal opportunity housing commission that Mayor Daley had set up. So when the bids went out, mine got special consideration. This other guy, the Moke, I have no doubt that his bid was lower. He knew his way around, and he must have had his own contacts, but that time, I had the inside track. He smiles. The gruesome teeth appear, then disappear again. Moke's bid somehow gets lost. Comes in too late. Bad luck. Chicago Potsy nails the job. Then, 4 years later, the Moke shows up here, bidding on the Libertyville job. Only that time, when I beat him, everything was square John. I pulled no strings. I met him in the bar at the Nelson Hotel the night after the contract was awarded, just by accident. And he says, "You were that guy in Chicago." And I say, "There are lots of guys in Chicago." Now, this guy was a Moke, but he was a scary Moke. He had a kind of smell about him. I can't put it any better than that. Anyway, I was big and strong in those days. I could be mean, but I was pretty meek that time. Even after a drink or two, I was pretty meek. "Yeah," he says, "there are a lot of guys in Chicago, but only one who diddled me. I still got a sore ass from that Potsy, and I got a long memory. Any other time, any other guy, I might have asked how good his memory stayed after he got his head knocked on the floor. But with him, I just took it. No more words passed between us. He walked out. I don't think I ever saw him again. But I heard about him from time to time while I was working the Libertyville job, mostly from my subs. Seems like the Moke was building a house of his own in French Landing for his retirement. Not that he was old enough to retire back then, but he was getting up a little. 50s, I'd say, and that was in 72. He was building a house here in town, Jack muses. Yeah, it had a name, too, like one of those English houses, the Birches, Lake House, Beardsley Manor, you know.
What name?
Shit, I can't even remember the Moke's name. I'd expect me to remember the name of the house he built. But one thing I do remember, none of the subs liked it. It got a reputation.
Bad?
The worst. There were accidents. One guy cut his hand clean off on a bandsaw, almost bled to death before they got him to the hospital. Another guy fell off a scaffolding and ended up paralyzed. What they call a quad, you know what that is?
Jack nods.
Only house I ever heard of people were calling haunted even before it was all the way built. I got the idea that he had to finish most of it himself.
What else did they say about this place?
Jack puts the question idly, as if he doesn't care much one way or the other. But he cares a lot. He has never heard of a so-called haunted house in French Landing. He knows he hasn't been here anywhere near long enough to hear all the tales and legends. But something like this? You'd think something like this would pop out of the deck early.
Ah, man. I can't remember. Just that...
He pauses, eyes distant. Outside the cell, the crowd is finally beginning to disperse. Jack wonders how Dale is doing with Brown and Black. The time seems to be racing, and he hasn't gotten what he needs from Potter. What he's gotten so far is just enough to tantalize.
"One guy told me the sun never shone there even when it shone," Potter says abruptly. "He said the house was a little way off the road, in a clearing, and it should have gotten sun at least 5 hours a day in the summer, but it somehow didn't. He said the guys lost their shadows, just like in a fairy tale, and they didn't like it. And sometimes they heard a dog growling in the woods. Sounded like a big one. A mean one. But they never saw it. You know how it is, I imagine. Stories get started, and then they just kind of feed on themselves."
Potter's shoulders suddenly slump. His head lowers.
"Man, that's all I can remember.
What was the Moke's name when he was in Chicago?"
"Can't remember."
Jack suddenly thrusts his open hands under Potter's nose. With his head lowered, Potter doesn't see them until they're right there, and he recoils, gasping. He gets a noseful of the dying smell on Jack's skin.
"What? Jesus, what's that?"
Potter seizes one of Jack's hands and sniffs again, greedily.
"Boy, that's nice. What is it?"
Lilies, Jack says, but it's not what he thinks. What he thinks is the memory of my mother. What was the moke's name when he was in Chicago?
It... something like Bierstein. That's not it, but it's close. Best I can do.
Bierstein, Jack says. And what was his name when he got to French Landing 3 years later? Suddenly there are loud, arguing voices on the stairs.
I don't care, someone shouts.
Jack thinks it's Black, the more officious one.
It's our case, he's our prisoner, and we're taking him out now.
Dale,
I'm not arguing, I'm just saying that the paperwork, Brown, ah, fuck the paperwork, we'll take it with us.
What was his name in French Landing, Potsy?
I can't.
Potsy takes Jack's hands again. Potsy's own hands are dry and cold. He smells Jack's palms, eyes closed. On the long exhale of his breath, he says,
Burnside. Chummy Burnside. Not that he was chummy. The nickname was a joke. I think his real handle might have been Charlie.
Jack takes his hands back. Charles Chummy Burnside, once known as Bierstein, or something like Bierstein. And the house. What was the name of the house? Brown and Black are coming down the corridor now, with Dale scurrying after them.
There's no time, Jack thinks. Damn it all, if I had even 5 minutes more.
And then Potsy says,
Black House. I don't know if that's what he called it or what the subs working the job got to calling it, but that was the name, all right.
Jack's eyes widen. The image of Henry Layden's cozy living room crosses his mind, sitting with a drink at his elbow and reading about Jarndyce and Jarndyce. Did you say Bleak House?
Black, Potsy reiterates impatiently, because it really was.
It was, oh dear to Christ, one of the state troopers says in a snotty look with the cat dragged in voice that makes Jack feel like rearranging his face. It's Brown, but when Jack glances up, it's Brown's partner he looks at. The coincidence of the other trooper's name makes Jack smile. Hello, boys, Jack says, getting up from the bunk.
What are you doing here, Hollywood?
Black asks.
Just batting the breeze and waiting for you,
Jack says, and smiles brilliantly. I suppose you want this guy.
You're goddamn right, Brown growls. And if you fucked up our case,
gosh, I don't think so, Jack says. It's a struggle, but he manages to achieve a tone of amiability. Then, to Potsy, you'll be safer with them than here in French Landing, sir. George Potter looks vacant again, resigned.
Don't matter much either way, he says,
then smiles as a thought occurs to him.
If old Chummy's still alive and you run across him, you might ask him if his ass still hurts from that diddling I gave him back in 69. And tell him old Chicago Potsy says hello.
What the hell are you talking about? Brown asks, glowering. He has his cuffs out and is clearly itching to snap them on George Potter's wrists. Old times, Jack says. He stuffs his fragrant hands in his pockets and leaves the cell. He smiles at Brown and Black. Nothing to concern you boys. Trooper Black turns to Dale.
You're out of this case, he says.
Those are words of one syllable. I can't make it any simpler. So tell me once and mean it forever, Chief. Do you understand?
Of course I do, Dale said.
Take the case and welcome.
But get off the tall white horse, will you? If you expect me to simply stand by and let a crowd of drunks from the sandbar take this man out of Lucky's and lynch him.
Don't make yourself look any stupider than you already are, Brown snaps. They picked his name up off your police calls.
I doubt that, Dale says quietly, thinking of the doper's cell phone borrowed out of evidence storage.
Black grabs Potter's narrow shoulder, gives it a vicious twist, then thrusts him so hard toward the door at the end of the corridor that the man almost falls down. Potter recovers, his haggard face full of pain and dignity.
Troopers, Jack says.
He doesn't speak loudly or angrily, but they both turn. Abuse that prisoner one more time in my sight, and I'll be on the phone to the Madison Shoe Fly Pies the minute you leave, and believe me, troopers, they will listen to me. Your attitude is arrogant, coercive, and counterproductive to the resolution of this case. Your interdepartmental cooperation skills are non-existent.
Your demeanor is unprofessional and reflects badly upon the state of Wisconsin. You will either behave yourselves, or I guarantee you that by next Friday, you will be looking for security jobs. Although his voice remains even throughout, Black and Brown seem to shrink as he speaks. By the time he finishes, they look like a pair of chastened children. Dale is gazing at Jack with awe. Only Potter seems unaffected. He's gazing down at his cuffed hands with eyes that could be 1,000 miles away. "Go on now," Jack says. "Take your prisoner, take your case records, and get lost." Black opens his mouth to speak, then shuts it again. They leave. When the door closes behind them, Dale looks at Jack and says very softly, "Wow."
"What?"
"If you don't know," Dale says, "I'm not going to tell you." Jack shrugs. Potter will keep them occupied, which frees us up to do a little actual work. If there's a bright side to tonight, that's it.
"What did you get from him? Anything?"
"A name. Might mean nothing. Charles Burnside, nicknamed Chummy. Ever heard of him?" Dale sticks out his lower lip and pulls it thoughtfully. Then he lets go and shakes his head.
"The name itself seems to ring a faint bell. But that might only be because it's so common. The nickname, no.
He was a builder, a contractor, a wheeler-dealer in Chicago over 30 years ago, according to Potsy, at least."
"Potsy?" Dale says.
The tape is peeling off a corner of the "one call means one call" sign, and Dale smooths it back down with the air of a man who doesn't really know what he's doing.
"You and he got pretty chummy, didn't you?"
"No," Jack says, "Burnside's chummy. And Trooper Black doesn't own the Black House."
"You've gone dotty. What Black House?"
"First, it's a proper name. Black, capital B, House, capital H. Black House. You ever heard of a house named that around here?"
Dale laughs. "God, no."
Jack smiles back, but all at once it's his interrogation smile, not his I'm-discussing-things-with-my-friend smile. Because he's a coppiceman now, and he has seen a funny little flicker in Dale Gilbertson's eyes.
"Are you sure?"
"Take a minute, think about it."
"Told you no. People don't name their houses in these parts. Oh, I guess old Miss Graham and Miss Pentel call their place on the other side of the town library Honeysuckle because of the honeysuckle bushes all over the fence in front. But that's the only one in these parts I ever heard named."
Again, Jack sees that flicker. Potter is the one who will be charged for murder by the Wisconsin State Police. But Jack didn't see that deep flicker in Potter's eyes a single time during their interview because Potter was straight with him. Dale isn't being straight. "But I have to be gentle with him," Jack tells himself, "because he doesn't know he's not being straight." How is that possible? As if in answer, he hears Chicago Potsy's voice.
"One guy told me the sun never shone there even when it shone. He said the guys lost their shadows, just like in a fairy tale."